While recent hurricanes have captured the attention of most of the country now for a few weeks, there is another situation on the western side of our nation that is just as devastating, but not quite capturing the headlines. And those are the wildfires that are burning in several of the mountain and Pacific Coast states, threatening to destroy numerous homes. Tens of thousands of acres are on fire. Many firefighters are working tirelessly to try to put out the blazes. And the thing about wildfires is they're so unpredictable. A shift in the wind can turn a fire, and so quickly that people can't react. You may remember a year or two ago, I believe it was in Arizona, a whole group of firefighters were killed when the winds changed and they were engulfed and had no time to react. Earlier this year in central Portugal, a wildfire raged so fiercely and swiftly, 63 people were killed. Many of them burned to death in their cars as they were trying to flee the fires, but the fires were faster than they were. That particular wildfire was caused by a lightning strike in a particularly dry area. Others have been caused by a careless camper that didn't put their campfire out sufficiently, or some have been the intentional work of an arsonist. But whatever the cause, once ignited, a wildfire burns out of control. You know, there was a similar phenomenon that happened in the first century Roman Empire. Michael Green writes, within 10 years of the death of Jesus, the gospel about him had reached Alexandria and Antioch, the two most notable cities of Africa and Asia at that time. Certainly it had been gone to Rome by then. It was so notorious a movement that in the capital city of the world, the Christians were made scapegoats by the Emperor Nero just 30 years later. Interesting side note, in the Roman histories, the historian Tacitus speaks of multitudes of Christians who were rounded up in Rome in the mid-60s, 30 years after the crucifixion of Jesus. And when he uses multitudes, he's usually talking about hundreds or even thousands. That's how quickly Christianity had spread. Green goes on to write, the message spread like wildfire throughout the whole empire. And were it not for the persecuting tendencies of Domitian, there probably would have been a Christian emperor by the end of the first century. Now we're going to see one step of this building fire, wildfire, in our message today. Our text is very brief. The four verses that Sandra read earlier, that's all we're going to cover. But it proves to be a watershed in the book of Acts. Luke refers back to it several times as a launching pad for the gospel. The events that took place here had a huge impact in the spreading of the good news of Jesus. He regarded this as an essential part of the history of the early church. Now you'll remember in our last study in chapter 7, Stephen, who was one of seven Greek-cultured or Hellenistic Jews who had been appointed to solve a problem within the early church, he was also very gifted and eloquent, and he was able to persuade many fellow Greek-cultured Jews to come to Christ. But there were those who didn't like that, and they stirred up trouble and eventually had him dragged out and stoned to death. That's where chapter 7 ends. And chapter 8 begins with the words, and Saul was there giving approval to his death. This is Saul of Tarsus, who was somehow instrumental in Stephen's murder. He may have been one of the witnesses, or he may have been the lead prosecutor, we're not sure. But he was part of the Sanhedrin that turned on Stephen and in a furious rage, dragged him outside the city and put him to death. Luke goes on to say that on that day a great persecution broke out against the church at Jerusalem, and all except the apostles scattered throughout Judea and Samaria. That ferocious rage that spun out of control in the Sanhedrin now spilled over into the streets of Jerusalem. Luke uses the word persecution here. It's the first time you see it in the book of Acts. What we mean by persecution is harassing somebody in order to persuade or force them to give up their religion, or simply to attack someone for religious reasons. We see a lot of prejudice in the world today. Some of it is racially based, some of it is ethnically based, some of it is culturally based, and some of it is religiously based. And that is what the word persecution entails. And it breaks out there in the city of Jerusalem. Now, Luke mentions that some godly men buried Stephen and mourned deeply for him. To fully appreciate this, you have to understand how they handle death and funerals over in the Middle East. And it's still true to this day. There is no quiet weeping over in a corner somewhere. When they mourn, they let everybody know it. In fact, in the first century, you could hire professional mourners to weep and wail as the body is carried to its resting place. Funeral processions were not quiet and dignified. They still aren't. They are very loud. And the idea is the more mourning, the more wailing and weeping, the greater the love for the person that has died. Now, something else you'll notice, and it does happen in our country and it does happen in other nations as well, sometimes a funeral procession turns into a protest march. If there has been a questionable motive behind someone's death, if it seems that the government or some authority has overstepped their bounds in causing death, that funeral can become a protest. And you almost get the impression that's what happened here. Some of the Christians were making sure everybody knew this isn't right. What they did was illegal. What they did was immoral. And they put themselves at great risk. You see, in those days, Jewish law allowed for an executed criminal to be buried. That was okay. But they really frowned on mourning for them. And I'm sure that the members of the Sanhedrin were not happy that these Jews, who were Christians, were making a big scene out of Stephen's burial. But they were taking a stand for what's right. And I know that you see protests in our day, and sometimes they're done right, and sometimes they're done wrong. Sometimes they're done for valid reasons, and sometimes they aren't. But there are times when it is legitimate. There are times when it is proper to take a stand against what's wrong. I think, if anything, Christians don't do it enough. We sit back and allow things like racism and prejudice to go on, and we don't say anything. And even by our silence, we're condoning it. Here were men who stuck their necks out, who risked the wrath of the Sanhedrin, the very people who put this guy to death, to let people know this isn't right. Saul, on the other hand, began to destroy the church. The Greek verb used here expresses a brutal, even a sadistic cruelty. It's used elsewhere in ancient literature to describe a wild animal that mangles its prey. That's the idea of what Saul was doing. He himself would later describe his actions as entering houses and synagogues, dragging Christians out, having them imprisoned and beaten. Now, if they renounced their faith in Christ, he called that compelling them to blaspheme, they would be set free. But if they did not recant, they would be killed. or put into prison. Now, we do see this in other parts of the world. We don't see this here today. It's hard for us to even comprehend what that must have been like. For somebody to come up to you and say, "You're a Christian, you need to renounce Jesus, or we're going to burn your house down. We're going to kill your children in front of you. We're going to make you run off and run for your lives, or we'll just put you to death." A great persecution. I think it was probably a shocking persecution at the time. They weren't expecting anything like this. And we know that Saul of Tarsus would later become known as Paul the Apostle. He would later write almost half of the books of the New Testament. But at this point in the story, try to appreciate how the Christians would have viewed Saul of Tarsus. He would have been like Adolf Eichmann would have been to the Jews in 1930s Germany, the architect of a Holocaust. Paul was determined to exterminate these Christians. He wanted to put an end to this movement right now. And he was doing everything in his power to do so. Now, the result of this startling persecution, you see at the end of verse 1, all except the apostles were scattered throughout Judea and Samaria. The murder of Stephen and the subsequent persecution of Christians led to the scattering population of the believers. Now, it's obvious that all of the Christians didn't leave. Luke here mentions the apostles stayed. We read later on in chapters 12 and 15 of the Christians who were still there, and they were quite numerous in Jerusalem. There was the circumcision party in chapter 11. Later on, there were poor Christians in Jerusalem that Paul took up a collection for, the churches that he had planted. So what Luke is referring to here is a particular group within the church. And it seems that it was those Hellenistic Jews. It was the Greek culture Jews within the church at Jerusalem. Remember, that's the group that Stephen came out of. They seem to be the targets of this particular persecution. The Hebrew Jews tended to stay. And you find the Jewish church is more of the Orthodox leaning, more so than the Greek leaning. But those who were of that group that had become the main target of the attack, they were the ones that were compelled to leave Jerusalem. Luke would later write in Acts 11, verses 19 and 20, "Now those who had been scattered by the persecution in connection with Stephen," so pointing right back to this time, "traveled as far as Phoenicia, Cyprus, and Antioch, telling the message only to Jews." So these are Jews going and preaching to other Jews. "Some of them, however, men from Cyprus and Cyrene, went to Antioch and began to speak to Greeks also, telling them the good news about the Lord Jesus." So you see now, first to the Jew and then to the Greek. It is spreading. It is taking the precise sequence God had ordained. And it's getting outside of Jerusalem. Now, Luke specifically mentions that the apostles did not leave. He is not criticizing them at this time. In fact, if anything, I think he's commending them. They saw it their duty to stay for the sake of the Christians who remained there, but also for those who were being imprisoned, those who were being persecuted, them staying put and continuing the ministry of the church was a great encouragement to them. So sometimes we're called to move, sometimes we're called to stay. In whichever place God would have us to be at that time. You know, few people in our culture can even comprehend what these people were going through at that time. We've just never had this kind of persecution for religious reasons yet. It may be coming. It wouldn't surprise me if it did. But I will admit, it's hard to be able to feel what they must have felt. I will say this, though. While many of them left Jerusalem, they fled to other areas. They didn't defect. They never lost their faith in Jesus. In fact, they spread it, as we're going to see in a little bit. In fact, verse 4 records the spreading proclamation. Those who had been scattered preached the word wherever they went. Now that word scattered literally means to scatter seed. How many of you remember, as I did, finding dandelions out in the yard? Now, I'm not talking about when they were bright yellow. I'm talking about when they're fully mature and they look like a cotton ball on top of the stem. You know what I'm talking about? And I can remember as a child thinking it was so cool to blow on that and watch those little things fly everywhere. I had no idea what those things were. They're seeds. Which means when you blow one of those and they fly all over the place, you've just planted a whole batch of dandelions in somebody's yard. But that's the idea here. Scattered, it means to scatter seed. And that's what happened to the gospel. See, persecution does to the church what wind does to that dandelion. It scatters it and it produces a greater harvest. The believers in Jerusalem were God's seed, and the persecution, and I'm not saying that God inspired that persecution. Those were the decisions of those men that did it. But God can use even horrible decisions and actions to bring about His will. And He used this horrible circumstance to spread the gospel, to get it outside the city of Jerusalem into Judea and Samaria. Remember Acts 1:8? You will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, in Judea, in Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. Well, this is how it was done. Now, the word that is used for scattered here in the Greek is a word diaspora. It was a word often used in the Old Testament to describe the Israelites who were scattered. The northern kingdom of Israel, when it was defeated by the Assyrians, the Jews were scattered. In fact, they call them the 10 lost tribes of Israel because nobody knows what happened to them. They just kind of scattered and disappeared. The difference, though, is that this dispersion did not force them to lose their identity. You see, when the Israelites in the Old Testament were dispersed, they didn't take Judaism with them. They didn't share in the new places they were, well, this is our God and this is who we worship. Instead, they became like the other peoples, and that's why they disappeared. The Christians went into new places, but they maintained their faith and they shared that faith. I think that's a challenge to us today because we are always confronted with the temptation to either stand up to the world or become like the world. When we see something going on, if we see somebody being harassed, we can either stand up against it or we can join in. Now, the easy answer is to join in. The easy answer is to become like everybody else because that's comfortable. They will accept us. But the right answer is to maintain our faith and to take a stand for what's right. They had a choice to make. And the church, as they were scattered, maintained their identity and in fact spread it, rather than being assimilated into the culture of the day. Now we're told here that those who were scattered preached the word. That's a really unfortunate translation. Because I can almost see, as you hear that verse, a sigh of relief. Right? Those who were scattered preached the word. Whew. That disqualifies me because I'm not a preacher. I don't know how to preach. I don't want to know how to preach. And I ain't going to do it. See, it's the preachers that are supposed to spread the word, not us. That's not what it says. In fact, there's two words in the Greek that are translated preach, and they both appear in subsequent verses in the book of Acts. Verse 4 says, those who were scattered preached the word everywhere they went. Verse 5, right after, it talks about Philip going to Samaria and preaching the word there. Two different Greek words. The one in verse 5 where Philip preached, that's the word like what I'm doing right now. Proclaiming as a herald. Announcing. Formal preaching, you might say. The word in verse 4, though, is different. The Greek word in verse 4 is the word from which we get evangelize, and it simply means to share good news. Let me give you an example from the Old Testament. In the book of 2 Kings, I don't want you to turn to it now because it'll probably take you the rest of the hour to find it. In the book of 2 Kings, chapter 6, the Israelite capital of Samaria has been surrounded by the Syrian army. They had a strategy back then. Instead of just attacking it, they would surround it and starve it out. They called it a siege. And the Syrians laid siege to Samaria, and pretty soon the people inside the city were starving. It got so bad that as the king was going through the city, a woman stopped him and said, "King, you need to judge between me and my neighbor. We made an agreement that yesterday we would kill my child and eat it, and tomorrow we would kill hers. And we killed my child and ate it yesterday, and now she has hidden her child. Do something about it." That's how bad it was. Well, there's four lepers who lived within the city walls because they had to be separated from the rest of the population. And you know, they were probably the first ones to go without food. So they're on the brink of starvation. And in their desperation, they said, "Why don't we just surrender? I mean, what's the worst that can happen? They're either going to take us prisoner and they'll feed us, or they'll kill us and put us out of our misery. Either way is better than this." So they got a stick and a white rag, you know, and came with the flag of surrender. And they walk out to where the army is, and all the tents are still there, and all the weapons and, you know, everything's there, but there's no army. They all left, and they left in such a hurry that they left all of their tents and all of their weapons and all of their clothes and all their food. Oh, man. You think Sunday at the buffet is something. Think about these guys. They haven't eaten in days. And they're just going from one tent to the other and stuffing their faces as fast as they can. And I'm sure they're probably, you know, kidding each other. They'll pick up a robe, say, "Hey, is this my size? You know, how do you think this looks on me?" They're having a grand old time. And then all of a sudden, a realization sets in. The verse I want to share with you is 2 Kings 7, 9. "Then they said to each other, 'We're not doing right. This is a day of good news, and we're keeping it to ourselves. If we wait until daylight, punishment will overtake us. Let's go at once and report this to the royal palace.'" See, they had discovered life. They had discovered food in a starving location, or people that were starving to death. And there was enough food there to feed the whole city. But here they are just stuffing themselves without a concern for anybody else. And finally they realize, this is not right. Now I'm sure that none of those guys were preachers. I'm sure that when they went to the royal palace and knocked on the door, said, "Hey, there wasn't some big eloquent speech." They probably said, "We found food." Right? Probably very direct and to the point. They didn't have to come up with a 3-point outline and all these, you know, cross references and illustrations to preach a sermon. They just needed to tell somebody, "We found food." That's what it's required of us. In fact, I heard someone once describe evangelism as one beggar telling another beggar where to find bread. That's not bad. You don't need to be eloquent for that. You just need to know where the bread is. And folks, we are living in a day of good news. And we're keeping it to ourselves. When was the last time any of us seriously talked to somebody out there that doesn't know Jesus and tell them the good news of what Jesus has done for them? When's the last time we did that? See, we get so comfortable in our little church family. We know everybody. It's nice and it's warm and it's predictable. It's familiar. We like it. I'm not saying that Texas Christian Church is going to become a mega church of 10,000 people. That's not my point. I'll be honest with you. As much as I'd love to see new believers come to join our fellowship, I don't care if they go to another church as long as they know Jesus. That's the point. Our problem is not that we aren't bringing people to church. Our problem is we aren't bringing people to Christ. That's what we need to be doing. And you don't have to be a scholar to do it. You don't need special training. You say, I don't know how. There's a book on the back table that we went through 2 months ago, and it's still there. And it'll take you step by step how to lead somebody to Christ. So we have no excuse that we don't know how to do it. The problem is, we just don't. And we need to get to doing it. You see, the sad thing about what happened here is that it took something catastrophic to get those people to fulfill the commission. Jesus said, Jerusalem, then Judea and Samaria. And they were content to stay in Jerusalem. Who knows, if this hadn't happened to Stephen and the subsequent persecution by Saul, they might still be in Jerusalem. In their nice, comfortable little group. It took a disaster to get them to move. And unfortunately, that's human nature. What did it take for Americans to quit bickering amongst themselves and to come together as a nation? It took 9/11. It took the horrible atrocity of thousands of people dying in an act of terror for Democrats and Republicans to put down their party politics and act like Americans. Unfortunately, it only lasted about 3 months. Then we were right back to where we were. The same was true in churches. Churches were packed in the aftermath of 9/11. All kinds of people, oh God, we need you. Oh God, we've been unfaithful and all that. And how long did it last? Probably about the same length of time. And I know of people, I know of Christians, that the only time they come to church is when something horrible happens in their family. The only time they pray is when some threat comes along. And they're so quick to say, I can't believe God would do this. Well, maybe God didn't do it, but if he's using it to call you back to him, he'll do that. Wouldn't it be better if we took the initiative? Instead of waiting for a catastrophe, let's get out there and do our job now. Let's do what we're called to do now. Maybe it wouldn't take something so devastating to get us moving. We are called to take the gospel wherever we go. Now, the devil is always going to try to defeat us. This is the first persecution that's recorded, but it isn't the last. You see persecutions throughout the Roman era. You go through church history, and there's been persecutions all along. I mentioned a few weeks ago, more people lost their lives for their faith in the 20th century than in the first 19 centuries combined. So it's still happening today. It's just not happening here yet. But do we have to wait for it to happen? Is that what it's going to take to get us moving as Christians, to get us to do what we're supposed to do? I pray not. I pray that it doesn't take something that terrible. But if it were to happen, as it has happened in the past, you will find those who really have their faith in Jesus Christ don't lose it. Back in 1949, the communists took over China. At that time, there were 637 Christian missionaries in the nation of China. There were estimated about 1 million Christians. Of course, you know, China is a huge population, so 1 million wasn't, you know, like a big majority, but it was a substantial number. But when the communists came in, they outlawed Christianity, forced all the missionaries out, and tried to shut down the churches. Within 4 years, 286 of those same missionaries had been redeployed to other nations there in Southeast Asia. And what was most amazing of all, 50 years later, when China allowed the West some access to what was going on in that nation, the Church of Jesus Christ had not disappeared, but in fact had grown to an estimated 50 million Christians. During the time when it was illegal to be a Christian, where you could go to jail for reading a Bible or hosting a service in your home, and many people did, the church did not shrivel up and die. It grew. Now again, it's unfortunate that it often takes something like that in order for the church to grow. And I think it's because, just like the Israelites in the Old Testament, when we get comfortable, we get complacent. When everything's going well, we don't even think about God. We don't think about Jesus. We don't think about other people needing Him until disaster strikes. I'm sure in those days in the first century, we might have used the word senseless tragedy, or a terrible waste of life when it came to Stephen and some of these others that were killed for their faith. But God worked in those horrifying events to build His church. It's seldom is it possible to judge the true significance of an event at the time they occur. Usually we have to wait and look at it back with hindsight and say, oh yeah, God was at work. I want to challenge you today. Let's not wait for something terrible to motivate us to spread the good news of Jesus. God will use adversity if He has to. And for too many of us, that's what it takes to get us moving. But if we would be faithful in sharing Christ consistently, we would see people come to Christ regularly rather than rarely. And when I was a teenager, I remember learning a simple chorus, and some of you may remember it too. I thought it was a good way to end our message today. It only takes a spark to get a fire going, and soon all those around can warm up in its glowing. That's how it is with God's love once you've experienced it. You spread His love to everyone. You want to pass it on. That's what this message is all about. Pass it on. We're living in a day of good news, the good news of Jesus Christ. He offers life, He offers hope, He offers joy, He offers peace that no one's going to find anywhere else. And we have it. And it's our responsibility to pass it on. You think of the wildfires today, they're terrible, they're destructive. Could you imagine if the good news of Jesus would spread like wildfire in our community, in our country? What a difference it would make. We would see the church build up. We would see many come faith in Christ. So wherever you go, pass it on.